Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of film. I'm your host, Sophie, and if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave us a review on whichever platform you're listening on. To coincide with the release of Alex Garland's Civil War, Lab 111 will be screening his much-acclaimed film, Ex Machina, from 2014. And with that, on this episode, we will be exploring AI in film and what might be at stake for cinema. As always, I'm joined by Tom.
Hi.
Kiriko.
Hello.
Hugo.
Hey, what's up?
And we are also joined by Elliot.
Hello, hello.
Who will be
back in the driver's seat.
The microphone for me today.
Yeah, usually we start with what have we watched recently? Who wants to go?
I'll start.
Hit it.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, I've finally started to dive into the TV series of Miami Vice.
But only just now?
Oh my
long
God.
Gestating. It's been long in the making, but I finally started to dive into it. And it's as good as I hoped it would be. I watched the feature-length double bill pilot episode, which introduces the characters and sets up the arena and the world and whatnot. It's very vibey. It's very beautifully made. It's kind of touching. It almost made me cry at some point. So it's good. I'm really enjoying it.
How does it differ to the feature film?
In almost every sense, except for that maybe some of the character characteristics are, you know, overlapping between the original Rico Dubs and Sonny Crockett and the one in the 2006 film remake. But it's like, it's a totally different vibe and texture mostly to it. It really captures that era. There's one funny quote that I wanted to mention that there's an interview with Michael Mann, because he was the producer of the series, where he, like, this interviewer asked him, like, basically, is the series reflecting Miami, or was Miami starting to copy Miami Vice? And he said, no, it was very much the latter. Everybody started dressing like the characters in our TV series in Miami after the series came out. So basically, it's kind of like a leading influential piece of work vis-a-vis the fashion and the cars and whatnot. So yeah,
white suits.
Yeah, the white suits, that kind of stuff.
Nice.
Would you ever wear a white suit, Tom?
I do wear white suits. Yeah.
You go to Cannes.
Only in Cannes.
Yeah.
If there's one man that I know who wears white suits, it's Tom.
And the KFC guy. Yeah.
White suit man, what have you been watching?
Last thing I saw was June Part 2, Electric Boogaloo, Sandworm Boogaloo, which was a bit disappointing.
Really?
Yeah.
Surprising? No.
Surprising that it was disappointing. Yeah, because I was reading reviews that it had everything that the first part didn't have, which I thought was going to be emotional involvement.
Meat around the bones. Yeah,
yeah, and then it ended up being less emotionally involving than the first one. Because the thing with the first one was I thought it would look great, the art direction was super nice, and I could get into a sci-fi film like that, but it just, I gave zero fucks about anybody in the first one. And now it was even more. So, it has some moments, but I'm now not really necessarily looking forward to the third part, which is not going to be called June Part 3, but June Messiah.
That sounds like a franchise in the making.
And a spoiler. Yeah, you know, it's you watch the entire thing.
More deep.
But you know what film I did watch of his recently? Incendies.
Ah, yeah.
Which I really liked. Mm.
No, I mean, he's a great filmmaker, yeah. But What was that, Hugo? I think the bigger the project, the less, emotionally involving it becomes. And with Blade Runner, I could take that because it's about kind of about robots and about AI, which will come to later, I guess.
I guess.
If you look at his first few films, they are very much about people.
Yeah.
And Prisoners is very much about people. And then slowly it becomes this cold concrete and sandworms. Mm. Yeah, what was the line from Star Wars again? Sand, it's coarse and rough and gets everywhere.
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating, and it gets everywhere.
That's kind of like how this film is. Yeah.
How about you, Kiriko?
I saw a very sweet documentary, which is the opposite of a Dune production, which is made by one man. It's called Balcony Movie by a Polish dude.
Oh, I've seen that film. That's great.
Called Paweł Lowinski. And he sits on his home balcony for 165 days over a span of 2 years during the pandemic. And he films the pavement, which is like right under his front door, and just says hi to everyone who passes by and tries to make conversation. And in total, he speaks with 2,000 people.
Wow.
And like becomes friends with all of his neighbors, who then entrust him on the street with like all of their deepest secrets. And then you totally become part of this cute little Polish neighborhood. It's super adorable.
It's a really nice film, yeah.
It reminds me a bit of the Kosakowski movie, the one about the hole in the street, where he films the hole in the street from his balcony, and then weird shit happens.
It's a thing that I guess like a lot of maybe tired filmmakers do when they like don't want to go too far out. It's like Agnes Varda did that too, no? She did like my film about my street. It's like I get the idea.
We're also missing, or we shouldn't overlook, the Oscars. I mean, we did a whole episode right at the start where we sort of explain why we don't talk about it, but Christopher Nolan finally won.
Yeah, so deserved. So well deserved.
Oh
best,
my God,
best
yes.
living filmmaker right now. Not overrated in
what
any way.
What an icon.
As everybody knows listening to this podcast, is that we are huge fans. And this podcast in no way is paid for by Universal or Emma Thomas or anybody else. Hugo, can you say something about Christopher Nolan?
I find him actually much better than all of you. I remember that you did the episode on him and on Villeneuve, and that I was like, yes, but everything in reverse, because I kind of hate Villeneuve and I kind of like Christopher Nolan. So, Elliot, what did you watch?
Well, I watched Incendies by Denis Villeneuve, but also Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse in the cinema.
Back to back.
Not back to back. I actually really liked it. I have time for Marvel if they want to make these kinds of animations and stay away from the big blockbusters.
But you're an animation nut as well, right? You love animation films.
It's like crazy the amount of detail and skill that is in these animations, but also shows you what a big budget can do if people invest in animation. But I think it'd be one of the films I'd show my kids if I were to have kids. It's
nice.
I got that deep when I was watching it. It was just very moving emotionally. So I recommend anybody to watch it. But yeah, before we dive into the cold open, our longtime listener, Marcus, has kind of quite rightly raised the point that should we be calling it a cold open?
When we already did the cold open just now, basically. Yeah.
Thoughts?
Yeah, what did we say? Hot open, warm lukewarm. Open, lukewarm open.
Yeah.
It's a good point, though. We shouldn't call it the cold open.
No,
anymore.
But maybe those listening can let us know and they can write to us like Marcus did at Celebrating
It doesn't
Cinema.
Need to be a temperature
indicator.
Hot take.
We can make it, we can give it a little bit more flavor than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A saucy open.
No.
No.
Or just the introduction.
That's saucy.
Yeah, the hot introduction.
That's very, very hip.
A year ago, over 1,000 AI experts, researchers, supporters, and Elon Musk urged for a pause in AI development to assess its capabilities and dangers. Unsurprisingly, that didn't happen. For us film lovers, maybe we were distracted by the entertaining prospect of ChatGPT interactions akin to Samantha and Spike Jonze's Her. Or maybe we were too amused by the AI-generated video of Will Smith eating spaghetti. Some of us, myself included, couldn't shake the feeling of being plunged into another dystopian sci-fi narrative where machines could really take over. A year on, HAL continues to keep those pod bay doors open for now. However, in this time, OpenAI, the creators of ChatGPT, have also developed Sora, a text-to-video model, begging the question, how far are we from the first AI-generated movie, and what would that look like? Equally, for us film lovers, this ain't nothing new. We've seen a lot of this before. AI has been a returning theme for almost a century in film, the subject of some of the most iconic films in cinema. Immediately, Fritz Lang's 1927 Metropolis comes to mind. In a not too similar political climate to today, this German expressionist landmark of the 1920s Weimar Republic is regarded as the pioneering science fiction film, set in the year of 2026. We witness a city where the idle rich live in penthouses with their pleasure gardens, while the workers are slaves to the machine. Sound familiar? In fact, we see a robot built to resurrect hell. That's hell, but spelt with one L. Cunningly, the robot is made with a humanistic likeness of Maria, a heroine and leader of the workers, so it can discredit her in an attempt to prevent an uprising, similar to how deepfakes threaten to be used today. Already 100 years ago, this was a warning of how our obsession with technological progress would corrupt us, not liberate us. Fast forward to the 60s, where Stanley Kubrick's HAL malfunctions in 2001: A Space Odyssey, leading to the subsequent malignant behavior. Despite this, HAL might just be the most human character in this film. Ridley Scott's Blade Runner in the 1980s depicted a dystopian world ravaged by capitalism, while the 1990s brought us The Matrix by the Wachowskis, where Keanu Reeves' Neo fights against machine oppression. 2010s, we had the aforementioned Her, as well as Alex Garland's Ex Machina, which showed why maybe we should be fearful of the humans programming the machines and not just the machines, as well as Denis Villeneuve's sequel to Blade Runner in 2017. The recurring dystopian portrayal of AI in cinema seems to reflect more our collective anxieties about AI's potential to surpass human control, but also our failure to avoid self-destruction. The cynic in me does think that, as depicted in Her, AI will one day leave us behind in pursuit of its own destiny. After all, what use will AI need for a species already hell-bent on bringing about its own self-extinction? Equally, however, AI could be the very thing that might just save us from ourselves. While AI struggles with visualizing clapping hands, maybe now is the moment to ask ourselves, how does cinema contribute to our understanding and relationship with AI?
It's a big question.
It's a big question.
But I thought maybe I could start by explaining what led me to bring up AI and why I wanted discuss it. So Tom showed me Sora. Have you guys come across Sora yet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on Twitter.
Here you go.
No.
So it's like the same people that made ChatGPT, and it's these like AI generated videos.
Oh, the one of the girl in the subway?
Yeah, that's one, for instance.
Yeah, or there's one where a cat jumps on the bed to cuddle with the owner.
Yeah, I think the most impressive one is like the helicopter flying through like Western America when it's like just horses and carriages and stuff. And I was quite alarmed at this technology. I thought, oh my gosh, this could mean so much. But then I thought about it and thought, it's the only thing that's going to happen is maybe processes within film are going to be automated a bit. And I sort of felt that we still need the human input no matter what in terms of creating films. Mm-hmm. But it led me to think about more about the films that I mentioned and their depictions of AI and what that perhaps reveal about where we might be with AI in terms of how it is now. I think I see it something similar to Her in terms of having more of a relationship with it and the chatbot. But yeah, I wondered what you guys thought about cinema and AI, because it's been around like I said.
I really love that in the cold open you immediately go to Metropolis in the 1920s to show that this kind of relationship between technology or robotics and human beings and let's say psychological, political implications are always fraught. I think just in general, there's this timeless aspect to AI and other technology that it comes from a place that we don't really have a strong grasp over in everyday life. There's an uncanny aspect of it, which I think you illustrate very well with the role of the robot that impersonates Maria in Metropolis, which is still such a poignant film. You know, that's fantastic that even with a theme as novel as AI, it's a film that immediately speaks to that as well. So I guess it makes sense, because film is often a cautionary tale and kind of speaks to the deepest fears and desires of people, that we immediately go to the uncanny, to the dystopian, to the evil computers taking over. So apparently, like, one of the biggest sci-fi films to ever, you know, like, establish the genre also goes there. So that's interesting. It just makes sense, I guess, because film is something and stories are, I guess, the thing that we like to say makes us distinctly human. The fact that we make films, that we make art, that we tell stories to each other, and then to have an interloper into inserted in our situations, immediately it gets perceived as an enemy, of course. Well, that was the conclusion
well, that
to
was the
podcast,
episode. And see you next week. Yeah, you're looking at me, Elliot, but I mean, why am I...
I want to hear what you have to think.
You know, what I keep wondering is why the... I always had the feeling that the "oh, it's bad" interpretation is also very much just a reflection of ourselves. Like, that's what we would do. Like, we would destroy you. Well, as you said in your cold open, we're already destroying ourselves. So wouldn't AI, when it becomes sentient, also just destroy us?
Yeah.
Because aren't we deserving of that higher intelligence just kills us all?
Yeah.
Like, what a bizarre... And I'm not saying that I think that it's only a positive and this will lead to robots and humans hand in hand walking to the horizon, cutesy. But it's at the beginning of this podcast we said we're not going to become philosophical and it immediately becomes this.
It's hard.
But you know what I mean? It feels like this like we've created something which is a reflection of ourselves, like just Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Even if you look at how we make robots, they have to look like us. So it's this constant, I have the idea that there is something beyond that, what AI can be, that we have no idea yet of what that could be, or that we want to restrain it in such a way that it will become this robot that does menial jobs that we don't want to do anymore, so that we can be in Malibu and drink cocktails by a robot.
But this is interesting because I think ultimately what this episode is also about is how films portray this relationship. You know, Metropolis does that, many other films does that, where the AI or the artificial intelligence or whatever is embodied by this kind of like android, humanoid kind of, you know, machine design. But then you have this film as 2001, which also shows this disembodied intelligence that is this kind of like omnipresent Alexa, Siri, like, you know, smart home kind of entity. And that's a super interesting film because it...
Does your Alexa ever say to you, put on your space helmet, Hugo?
All the time when I leave the house. Yeah.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
Yeah, I'm afraid I can't do that.
But it's that's interesting because that's, I think, such a landmark film for that reason as well.
Dave, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Rumors about something being dug up on the moon. I never gave these stories much credence, but particularly in view of some of the other things that have happened, I find them difficult to put out of my mind.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Yeah, we keep coming back to 2001, I guess, for that reason.
So. Yeah, I wanted to know what you thought, Kiriko, because you revisit 2001. A lot. I mean, for those that don't know, Kiriko watches it every 5 years with her mother, which I mean, it's very cute.
When is the next one due?
It should be soon, before I'm 30, so somewhere in the coming year, yeah.
When you've watched it, have you thought of, obviously it's like, obviously machine versus man, but have you ever sort of thought more about the AI aspect, or do you think only now you will because it's more of a topic?
I kind of agree with Tom that it's, I don't know, I think this idea of a robot or AI being an entity with a face and a voice is also something that cinema has completely created for us. I think it is only from cinema that we think of robots in this way. Whereas, of course, the span of what a robot has become up until now is also the thing that has made cinema what it is today. Like, apart from the AI factor, for example, the way in which animation can come so close to what we believe to be a reality, or that we come to, you know, like, have an emotional arc in, is also what a robot can do. And I think the rise of cinema has also been alongside the rise of what technology has been able to do. So it makes sense that it's like such a hand in hand medium of arts and the technology, because the art is dependent from the technology, of course. But I think, I don't know, it's, we were talking before we were recording that, or trying to think of a film that has a positive representation of AI or technology. And I think we couldn't come up with a film, no?
Nothing very strong.
Which is fucking silly, because I don't know. It's like this constant fear that we're also talking upon ourselves whilst the medium has also been so dependent on the great developments of technology.
Yeah, I think ironically her, you know, like we also said before the recording, does the most to actually show some applications that an AI can have in our everyday life that are worthwhile and emotionally, let's say, profound.
Good morning, Theodore.
Good morning.
You have a meeting in 5 minutes. You want to try getting out of bed? Get up!
You're too funny. I know you're living
in my mind. Theodore, I saw in your emails that you'd gone through a breakup recently.
You're kind of nosy.
Am I? You'll get used to it. My mind is not the same as being alive. Super century. So what was it like being married?
There's something that feels so good about sharing your life with somebody.
How do you share your life with somebody? If telling
the
truth is
not polite. The woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, she's an operating system.
You're dating in a West? What is that like?
I feel really close to her. Like, when I talk to her, I feel like she's with me.
I want to learn everything about everything. I want to discover myself.
I want that for you, too.
Keep going. Keep going.
The funny thing about that film is that the main character basically is not interesting enough for his companion AI, voiced by Scarlett Johansson. So she breaks up with him in this relationship that they have together.
Well, not only not interesting enough, but just not enough.
Yeah, not
because
enough.
Because she realizes more, that a polyamorphous relationship is far better than the monogamous relationship with one guy, with Joaquin Phoenix specifically.
21st century queen.
Yeah, this is such a New York 21st century, everybody is poly on their Tinder bio movie. Which was already my problem with that movie when it came out. It's too twee for me. But but that film does show kind of like the useful applications of it as well. But I have to say, frankly, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about that, but there's a part of me that finds ChatGPT and some of these other AI things kind of not cool. Like, it's kind of lame. And there's another thing with films that they don't really like to show smartphones that much, because it's annoying to film people being on their smartphones or interacting with screens, because the film itself is already considered a screen in any kind of like abstracted form, either projected in the cinema or when you watch it on the TV. So not a lot of filmmakers are comfortable with embedding one screen into the other. And then there's this entire world that you're shut off from, but there's also an entire type of guy or type of people that are like so insistent on how cool ChatGPT is, which are also usually not the people that you see that much in film. So there's too many things against it right now. I feel like for me, the AI just has to prove that it can be cool as well, because I'm not really seeing that much.
What would make it cool for you?
Sentience.
Sentience. Yeah, well, that would be a good start. Well, I like...
No, but I mean, like, the ChatGPT is like, I'm not an expert, but as I believe that ChatGPT is what they call narrow AI.
Yeah, so it's like a large language model.
Yeah, it's just learning from multiple sources and then incorporating that in an answer for a prompt. And that's the same thing that Sora does, but then on a visual level. Yeah. So it's stealing its ass off and then throwing everything in a bag and then saying here it is, it has six fingers. That's what sadly it still does. But then what was the other form is called, not broad AI, but I can't remember. I should have looked it up for this. But that's where it...
Yeah, we're huge experts.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
The AI panel,
we don't claim to be.
Yeah.
Then it's starting to think for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I believe there's maybe... Those things are actually happening, but those are very much they're being restrained by laws and stuff like that because everybody's afraid of what will happen.
But then it's only the guys that work at Google and stuff that are, you know, that find this the most important thing in life, which I already find silly. They're like, guys, this is getting so dangerous. But it's like, you are placing self-importance
into Bitcoin for you.
Basically, you have guys that were first into Bitcoin and then they were in
Cardano,
NFTs.
Cardano.
And then they're into AI and ChatGPT and large language models. And I'm like, dude, you're all hopping on the same kind of like bullshit. Anyway, that doesn't really matter for cinema, but I guess in a way it does because...
No, but okay, so let's take it back because I think... You're Bart Simpsoning it up by saying it's just lame.
Yeah, true.
This sucks and blows at the same time.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool with that hot take. But I think that I'm not as pessimistic as you. I'm very skeptical about it. But I think that there are, just on a work basis, when it does work better than it's working now, for even the language models... it could help. It could do stuff and it could do menial jobs that replace every fucking factory worker out there, which is going to be horrendous for the economy from another point of view. But, you know, what does that do for cinema?
Yeah.
And taking it back to Sora, when I was looking at it, I was thinking like, okay, so there are... You were talking about Marvel, about Spider-Man. If you look at the credits for those films... The longest parts for a Marvel, credits are all the animators, like 300 animators working on that. I think especially bigger studios as Disney or any big studio, and that's of course what the strikes were about also, is they're going to fucking be moved out because if it can do what Sora does and in 10 years there will be nobody working on CGI. You just text prompting it up and then there you go. You have Helen Mirren flying through the sky. I mean, well, not Helen Mirren because that's the entire thing that strikes were about, but it's going to make stuff like that way easier.
Should we maybe take it back to...
Yeah, the movies.
moments in film. So in my cold open, I mentioned how could be seen as sort of the most humane character in 2001 A Space Odyssey. What do you guys agree with that?
It's definitely the most memorable, I guess.
No, yeah, everybody's
super
cold.
How is he the most humane?
Cold.
Sorry, I don't...
This idea that... not only does he show emotion when he has his sort of breakdown and he sort of emits his fear to Dave, but also sort of similar in the book. So the reason why he supposedly malfunctions, you can either read it that he is also humane in the sense that he can also make mistakes. And that's why he malfunctions because he can't come to terms with it. But I think also in the book, they talk about how is programmed for the prioritizing the mission over life, and that's apparently where he become his dilemma of having to lie to people to protect the mission's sake rather than save their lives. And so
that's not humane.
No,
that's not humane.
What is
empathy?
But is that not empathy? Breaking down because you can't lie to people or because you're having to lie to people.
Next week on Celebrating Cinema, we will be discussing empathy.
Well, you know, they say famously that movies are an empathy machine, right?
Oh, yeah. Roger Ebert. He'll return as an AI.
I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that right now, but...
No, but I know what you mean, and also in the sense that, of course, everybody is super almost dead inside in 2001.
Yeah, that's true.
He's like the only, even if it's if his emotions or his emotions, air quotes, are wanting to destroy the Keir Delilah, that guy is the strangest name ever. Well, the main actor.
That's a pretty strange name, main actor.
The main actor, starring the main actor. At least he emotes in some way.
That's true. And maybe also the revelation of wanting to, or like killing others for oneself.
That's pretty
could
humane.
Be considered as
pretty
indeed
human.
the most human trait.
Now I'm thinking of what other movies or media kind of do that. I'm thinking about Westworld, where at some point, of course, you're more invested in the characters inside the simulation than than Anthony Hopkins, really.
And also in Blade Runner, because that's a movie that is about, you know, hunting these replicants that are these robotic slaves that have escaped this, you know, like mining planet. And then our main character hunts them, tries to track them down.
There was an escape from the off-world colonies 2 weeks ago. 6 replicants, 3 male, 3 female. They slaughtered 20.
A Blade Runner's job is to hunt down replicants. Manufactured humans you can't tell from the real thing.
What's this?
Roy Batty. Probably the leader.
There was just one outfit making replicants that superhuman. The Terrell Corporation.
Mr. Deckard, Dr. Eldon Tyrell.
I don't get it, Tyrell.
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto.
I was looking for 6 replicants in a city of 106 million people.
You ever see this girl, huh?
Never seen her, Buzlov.
What I didn't know was they were looking for me.
The whole film, I think, is about humanization and dehumanization of, like, to whom do we bestow the title of being human, and what rights does it grant you to be considered human compared to the other? It's a film that I think very much goes almost in this, like, moral dilemma. And I think the film raises this question, how much humanity is still left in our protagonist and how much of a full-bodied, you know, flesh and blood human he is.
Oh, well, I mean, the entire speech, the entire Tears in Rain speech, I've seen sea beams of the port of Orion, blah, 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 is, of course, very sort of sweeping romanticism of very much feeling alive.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears.
And then everything around it is very much dead,
dreary,
neon Atari signs and Coca-Cola commercials and dread.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And you also mentioned before, Tom, when we were discussing before the podcast, that it's often and sometimes in these films you see like AI wanting to live or wanting to become a human, but that's also quite a naive thing to assume that that's what AI would want.
That's why I don't like Spielberg's artificial intelligence.
In a distant future, in an age of intelligent machines, he is the first robotic child programmed to love and coexist as a member of a family. His is a tale of humanity and a journey to find his place among humans and machines.
I'm a boy.
You are a real boy. At least as real as I've ever made one.
Which is this hyper... That's almost his most sentimental film. Well,
wow.
With Spielberg, that's hard to really say. But yeah, it's the robot boy that wants to be a real boy.
Mm. And he's programmed to love, right?
Is he programmed to love? I can't even remember.
So. It's
that.
A long time ago since I've seen that film, but I remember loving it.
Of course.
I'm an unapologetic
I knew you were gonna
Spielberg.
Say that. Yeah,
I'm an unapologetic Spielberg fan, of course. Because it's also a weird film, I guess. But it's, I mean, it's not an insightful film about AI or robotics, but it's an insightful film about a boy, you know, and family and like society and that kind of stuff. The film is about one thing, but it's always with Spielberg actually about the other thing.
Well, it was the last project that Kubrick wanted to make, but then he died before making it, and then he kind of gave the reins to Spielberg before he died, and then Spielberg made this film.
Yeah.
Clearly... This doesn't really feel like the film that Kubrick maybe would have made. Mm-hmm. Because his sort of, there's of course in the entire body of work with Kubrick, as is with 2001, this strange play between a super austere world and what it kind of means to be human in that world.
Yeah.
Kiyoko, do you still like watching 2001?
Yeah, definitely.
What does it bring to you?
That's a fun question.
Take your time.
I think because the film, or maybe in general, the story, like the original, the written book, tries to be everything from the beginning of time till now about man, life, birth, death. You can really also sit back and just take something in every single time you watch it, and something completely different every single time you watch it. And I think it's super concrete and super vague at the same time, which I super love. So you can put a different angle on it in that sense, to try to understand something or just to really like enjoy whatever the film gives you in that moment.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's the ideal mode where a film could be in, to be like hyper specific and very abstract at the same time.
Yeah.
So it can be everything.
Yeah. It tries to tell you so much, but also it doesn't have to tell you anything at the same time, which is, I don't know, for a film, quite unique, I would say.
But that brings us maybe to The Matrix, if we're talking about AI things in film.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. What truth?
They're watching you, Neo.
Human beings are a disease. You are a cancer of this planet. And we are the cure.
Get me the hell out of here!
Welcome to the real world.
That is a film about this hero narrative, Neo, as this kind of like 21st century Jesus with his whole death and rebirth and resurrection and, you know, absolving people or a whole humanity of this, in this fight between good and evil. And the evil is the robots. But then it's actually the evil is the humans because they created the robots, and it's capitalism and it's like this and it's that. You know, there's like a zillion things just kind of like squished together in a 2.5 hour movie that works very well. But that's the thing that I was thinking about, that film is actually maybe very insightful also to approach AI as it is essentially a commercial technology, you know, owned by companies, like you say, OpenAI and that kind of stuff. And I think that Matrix very much shows that late stage capitalist malaise of this kind of boring ass world where everything is kind of flattened into one like monotonous sensory experience where things just feel very much the same. And I feel like that film still speaks to this moment specifically also in where we are with AI technology, mm-hmm. that there's a corporate dullness to everything that seems inescapable. And that is maybe why, to rationalize what I find boring about the whole ChatGPT thing.
Yeah, I get
it's used for like marketing people to write newsletters in MailChimp or to do Instagram posts that all feel the same. And there's this kind of like commercialized, neutered effect. And I feel like The Matrix captured that quite well.
But I think also because of that, I never have felt the fear that AI will take over humans' capacity of creativity, because we all feel this sense of like concentrated information, which then filters out like a very generic answer or story. Like you just immediately sense it, or at least maybe I'm too naive about that. But I don't...
Well, I think at some point the idea is that that won't be the case. I think that we are at a point now that it just doesn't function. If I sometimes ask ChatGPT to write a text for a program,
mm-hmm.
and it always comes up with the same mid-enthusiasm, mm-hmm. the same sort of... the same monotone... and semi-enthusiastic words that it uses to use, especially when you ask it to promote something, it becomes this stellar performances and
blah blah blah.
Join the blah blah blah. So it fails horribly at that.
Yeah.
But I think I'll give one good example of using ChatGPT. When we screened The Birdcage quite a while ago, I felt that the text that we needed to use on the website should at least sort of... And is this The Birdcage, the movie with Robin Williams and Nathan Lane playing a gay couple and Gene Hackman being a senator coming over and this clash of queerness and republicanism. Wow. It's a very dated film, but it was very important for showing... queer characters in mainstream cinema in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at that film from a distance now, it could feel like something which is wrong. So I asked ChatGPT, can you write something that sort of contextualizes this film within the era and how it now can be looked at as a period piece or like a time capsule, but what did it do then?
Can you PC it for me?
And it came up with this very, very nice text that needed lots and lots of work. But actually, it did probably find a very nice essay by somebody who just wrote a long form essay specifically on the representation of queer characters in 90s mainstream cinema. And it worked. But then again, this is not—it's not learning anything. It's just taking random sources and then rehashing it, and then coming up with it.
Yeah, that's what The Matrix also shows. Everything is a copy of a copy of a copy.
And I'm so happy that you say this, because this year we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of 1999.
Nice.
Because Everything is a Copy of a Copy of a Copy is Fight Club.
For 6 months, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep. With insomnia, nothing's real. Everything's far away. Everything's a copy of a copy of a copy.
And I'm like, wow, we're kind of moving in circles with this, what you just said, this idea of this capitalist, mediocre
era,
movement that we're still living
we had
in, apparently.
Like, angsty filmmakers that had, like, I'm not a huge Fight Club fan, but I do admire the film.
Neither was Roger Ebert.
No, okay, see, there you have it. I'm a copy of Roger Ebert. But, then we had filmmakers that made these kind of like angsty films that were fed up with that growing corporatization. And I feel like there's also this whole, let's say, it's a fight that is essentially aesthetically in maybe lost, you know? I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I feel like, you know, you have the Wachowskis with The Matrix, you have Fincher with Fight Club that really show the kind of like frustration with this growing cultural power that these mainstream corporations have, and this kind of like flattening of the texture of everyday life. These films fight against that. I'm not sure if there is many mainstream filmmakers that can that do that now. I don't know. Maybe they don't have to, but it is, I feel like, a distinctly 90s and early 2000s thing to be so against that, so explicitly in your mainstream productions.
I think we are seeing that again, but now it's become almost commodified and cliched that,
so yeah,
that Alex Garland's Civil War seems much more full of cliches that doesn't really, it's playing on that universal angst that we do have right now, but in a more palatable way, I guess, in a way that appeases to everyone.
But for instance, the fourth Matrix, right? The one that had to be made because the studio wanted the new Matrix. And yeah, then I think Lana Wachowski was like, well, then I'll just make it myself and make it not suck.
Yeah.
And that one is so, like, there's such a sense of defeatism in that film, yeah, where yeah, everything is just so dreary, this kind of corporate pressure to make these things. It's a lost battle, essentially, I guess. And then there's one more flight to, you know, this world underneath the world, which is for us essentially the fantasy world, because we can't escape
yeah,
our capitalist society. But it's, there's this hopelessness to that film that I found very sad.
Yeah, it's true.
Do you think that's more a reflection of people running out of ideas in that sense, or just more because it's become commodified?
No, I think it's what you and the Elliot and Tom's like point of earlier, basically that we are given the shitty input to yeah, the machines, and then we're afraid of the output of the yeah, machines instead of actually being more skeptical of what people are putting into it. Because all the people that are making this stuff are, let's face it, essentially a bunch of bozos, you know, like that, what do they know about cinema or art or life or empathy for all that matter? You know, like I was thinking, what is AI essentially good for? Doing maths, but I wouldn't trust it with a tech system because then we get a super racist system, you know? So what is it good for? I don't, like, I really don't know. Like that's,
yeah, I don't know. There's still something in me that would love the, when AI becomes fully sentient and it starts making its own art and we put it into a robot and it comes up to us and we're like, it's gonna take over mankind. No. And then it just goes like, no, motherfucker, I don't give a shit about you. This
and
is
just
fine.
Making
art. Let's vibe. Like, I'm just making my own art. Your art really sucks, by the way. Yeah, I'm just making my own shit. And then we look at that art and go like, jeez, we're so mediocre. And then there's this we're just fucking guilting ourselves, like, oh, actually maybe it should have killed us because we really mean nothing. Oh my god.
But so then it would trigger kind of like what photography did for painting, that we have to, you know, reconsider all the art output that we have and go full on meta expressionist
yeah,
to fight the kind
we're
of like
Trump AI again.
That would be interesting.
And then AI is sad, like, oh no, I could have done much better.
What, one thing I was thinking about is that so far we've had very dystopian depictions of AI.
Mm-hmm.
What, because there are going to be films about AI in the future, do you think they'll just continue being dystopian? Or
it would be nice if there would be something super fun and positive, like
yeah,
a cutesy ass.
Yeah, I want the Star Trek's Next Generation vibe, right? Mm, and okay, there are multiple episodes where Data is also bad, yeah, but most of the time he's just a guy with a cat hanging out, thinking about, of course, having emotions. And then when his emotion chip is installed, he cries and laughs at wrong jokes, you know?
Yeah, just silly little
silly,
guy.
Silly,
oh,
funny
I can't
things.
Think of a cute robot film. WALL-E.
WALL-E.
Oh, but that's actually about this kind of dystopian world where there's one
corporatism
cute
and commercialism.
Yeah, but the robot is sort of like the last man standing.
It's a super sad, cute robot in a harsh world.
He tries his best.
He's cute.
Yeah, he's cute. The robot is cute, but that's like the boy from AI being like in a dystopian world. Well, at least one boy is cute. It's like, yeah, nice. There's one film actually that I can recommend that's
one.
Well,
oh, in
only
general,
one.
Oh, on, this,
only
on one. This subject. Oh, okay.
On this subject. It's a very hardcore political leftist experimental documentary called Inventing the Future by this experimental filmmaker from Canada called Isaiah Medina. And it's this adaptation of a book by Alex Williams and Nick Schrinek about how the left needs to think long term to actually have a convincing argument as to how we should shape the world to come, because mm-hmm. we can't only I'm saying we as if, you know, you can't only react to things that are immediately in front of you short term as a viable political strategy. And one of those things, of course, is AI that should be incorporated. And so this film actually is kind of like a political pamphlet, but it really opts to embrace all AI and fold it into union strike work to basically automate as many jobs as possible and fight for universal basic income to liberate as many people from the need to labor, which is an interesting idea that I actually can, you know, rally behind. So that's one film that really thinks about AI also in a visual way, in an interesting manner, and sick. Actually tries to use it as a, let's say, liberatory, emancipatory tool for political economy. So that's pretty cool.
Sounds super sick.
Yeah.
But I have sad news. AI is going to be super right wing. It's, you know.
But surely it will. Just more. No.
Maybe, yeah, let's make it super political.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
But if it takes over the world, it's right wing. If it's good for us, it's left wing.
But it's like, right. Yeah, but it's like the people that code it, the people that make it are generally right wing, yeah. Are quite skeptical themselves. Like, it's funny, you know, film is often seen as a left wing thing. And in general, I think it is, like, broadly speaking. So there's naturally the skepticism of new technology, which is inherently, I would say, this kind of like business intersection between business, military, and that kind of stuff. So it is more right-wing. And now you have all these guys that want to be acknowledged culturally and have the tools to make it. And like, oh, you artists are going to be out of a job. But it's like, no, I don't think so. So I think it becomes the Civil War, Alex, you know, what's the guy's name?
Alex Garland.
Alex Garland's kind of thing. It's just going to be left versus right with AI, and we're just going to make nice movies, and they're just going to make trash. That's kind of my idea.
I'm just cracking up that you say that film is mostly a left-wing medium, and it comes out of the mouth of the biggest Clint Eastwood fan in the world. Like, the biggest...
He said mostly, okay?
Broadly speaking, he's doing some heavy lifting. But for everybody interested in my nuanced views on Clint Eastwood, there's an episode on that, so I won't dive into it here.
You did say you had hot takes. Do you have any more hot takes on AI?
Well, I think I already gave quite a few. I think these were most of them, that essentially it's all kind of lame, and and that I think that films are actually... I have one more good hot take, actually. Maybe that's an interesting one to throw in. But iRobot with Will Smith.
Oh, my God, love!
Underrated?
Yes, love. I would say my first robot film memory also.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous film.
We designed them to be trusted with our homes. With our way of life. With our world. But did we design them to be trusted?
The rollout of USR's new generation of robot, the NS5, was marred by the death of designer Alfred Lanning.
Identify. Murder's a new trick for a robot. Respond.
I did not murder him!
We're gonna miss the good old days.
What good old days?
When people were killed by other people.
Take my AI out of your fucking mouth. Isn't that one of the taglines?
Could be.
How would we like to end?
Can you maybe ask ChatGPT how to end the podcast episode?
How to end a podcast about AI?
It's going to be it's going to be lame.
Who says that?
you use that word.
How and to make end the podcast in the style of Tom Ohms.
And then ChatGPT. Oh, sorry for being so lame.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so lame.
Is it lame?
Yeah, it's giving me like 7 points. Summarize key points. Okay. Tease the next episode. Encourage engagement.
That's what we do, though.
Call to action. Express gratitude.
Express gratitude.
Leave on a thought-provoking note.
Well, that Hugo's trying to do that the entire episode.
Then sign off.
Nice. Yeah. Shall we do that?
Yeah.
Shall we just sign off?
Yeah.
Fuck the gratitude.
Listening to you guys is much more tiring when I'm not speaking myself. No offense.
That's great for a podcast. Yeah.
I express gratitude.
Sorry. If you enjoyed this episode, let us know by leaving a review on whichever podcast platform you're listening on or on our Instagram at Lab111.
Encourage engagement.
Yeah. If you have suggestions for what we should call our cold opens that are quite clearly not cold opens, then email us at celebratingcinema@lab111.nl.
It's actually pretty handy.
Want to listen to more conversations like this? Then check out our episode on 2001 A Space Odyssey, a whole discussion dedicated to this classic. Or listen to one of our very first episodes, Oscar Fever, where we try to make sense of this American event that seems to dominate the industry. This podcast was brought to you by Lab 111, produced and edited by Elliot Bloom, music from Hugo Emmerzau, and artwork by Studio FFF. Bye.
Expressing gratitude.